So hello and welcome everyone, and now getting to be a few familiar faces, although I don't know your names yet. I'm going to have to ask some of you your names today. So we'll follow the same basic schedule as on previous occasions, and I'll give a talk. After the talk, give you a few minutes to stretch your legs. We'll have a meditation period and then question and answer period. And then if anybody like to go for a walk, we go for a walk like we have on previous days. So I'll begin by talking about a group of dhammas or teachings that we call the perfections or the paramis. Before I go into these one by one, a few general comments. One is that it can be sometimes rather confusing when you compare teachings in different schools of Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism, as is found in Southeast Asia, and the Tibetan Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism of China and Northeast Asia. And one of the elements that can be confusing, particularly confusing, is the use of the word Buddha. And in the Theravada school, in the school which I belong, we consider that there can only be one Buddha at any one time. So now we're in the period under the influence of Gautama Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago in India. And eventually Gautama Buddha's Buddhism will decline and disappear, and then after a certain long period of time a new Buddha will arise. And this has been going on for incalculable eons and will continue for incalculable eons. But the point being that there, at one time, there is one Buddha. Now, after the Buddha passed away, the understanding of what the word Buddha means changed, and some would say developed. And the philosophy appeared that Buddha is a term denoting the highest stage of spiritual development. Now, in Theravada Buddhism, we consider the Buddha reaches the highest stage of spiritual development, becomes the Buddha. And then everyone else who practices the Dhamma, teachings of the Buddha, realize the same enlightenment as the Buddha realized. Many of the special qualities that he developed, but they're not considered to have reached Buddhahood. Okay. So in the Mahayana school, the idea was that the Arahant, which is the highest stage of development according to Theravada Buddhism, is not the end of the story, that there is a further stage which is called Buddhahood. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, there is the emphasis on practicing in order to become a Buddha. So there's just a bit of a background, in that even these most basic fundamental terms can be used in very different ways in different traditions. It's a lot more complex than I've in my short summary, but that's just to give you an idea that one shouldn't take for granted that the same words used in different sects, different traditions, necessarily have the same meaning. Okay, in this school of Buddhism, the teachings which came to predominate, particularly in general teaching of Buddhism to lay Buddhists following the Buddha's parinibbana, were based on a series of scriptures called the Jatakas, which purport to relate tales of the previous lives of the Buddha. So we understand that before Prince Siddhartha was able to realize enlightenment and become the Buddha, he had for an incalculably long period been practicing various kinds of virtues, and that these came to fruition in his last life as Prince Siddhartha. And some of you may have read some of these stories, and some of them recount lives when he was a human being, some as a deer, as a monkey, and all kinds of different animals. But the point being that these paramis were essential maturing factors which had to reach a point of fulfillment before his enlightenment could take place. So although in Theravada Buddhism arahantship is considered to be the highest level attainable by a human being in this eon or in this long period, many Theravadin Buddhists, both in the monastic order and lay Buddhists, have determined to develop the paramis with the wish that in some future time, immeasurable time in the future, one day that they will become one of the future Buddhas who's yet to be born. Now, even if, and then they practice these 10 paramis as their basic spiritual practice. Now, even if you don't have the wish and determination to become a future Buddha, these 10 paramis, I think, provide a very good overall foundation for spiritual development in the Buddhist sense of that word. And I think particularly as lay people, when the opportunities for you to have period of retreat and in solitude and to develop formal meditation probably not so frequent, this give you a very clear idea how you can be practicing and developing spiritually within an ordinary household life. We are in this day and age, I think, particularly technique oriented, and people tend to assume that success and failure in meditation, for instance, is a matter of technique and finding the technique that suits you and just applying that technique until you're successful. My own experience and my feeling is that parami is incredibly important. And what I mean by parami in this context is the extent to which one has accumulated these virtues over many lifetimes and in the course of this lifetime as well, will determine the speed and the ease in which one is able to benefit from the meditation techniques that you apply. So, I've seen over the years people who put a great deal of effort into meditation practice and into monk's life, and have had a very difficult time of it and not been particularly successful. Whereas I've seen other monks, particularly Thai monks, I would say, who just found everything just comes so easily, and it's not just a matter of their, you know, the effort that they put into it. It's just that they seem to have some store of accumulated spiritual power which they can draw upon. So I think that the paramis are a maturing force, and they give one the base, the emotional maturity to be able to get the maximum benefit from the teachings that one is applying. Okay, so I'm going to go through these paramis one by one now. And the first one is a familiar one for everyone, I think. This is Dana Parami, or the Parami of generosity. And the fact that generosity, giving, is always stressed as the fundamental spiritual virtue, whether we're talking in terms of the paramis or any other framework for presenting Buddhist teachings, I think is in itself refutation, this idea of spiritual life as being somehow selfish, a selfish endeavor. In the Buddhist teachings, we find that the Buddha is often talking about whether or not certain things can happen. And he's explaining what causes and conditions lead to this, what causes and conditions lead to that. One of the phrases that comes up a lot is, this will be unlikely, or this will be likely to happen. But there's another phrase which appears not so often, but is very important. It says, it's impossible. It's not possible for such and such a thing to happen. Absolutely, categorically impossible. And one of these phrases, one of these teachings, says that it's impossible for one afflicted by the defilement of stinginess to realize any of the more profound states of meditation. So very notable connection between how one lives in the world and how successful one may be in developing meditation. So this stinginess means that sense of, you know, basic fundamental attitude of poverty, that, you know, I need everything that I have, I've got to look after it, I don't want anybody else to have a share. And that very kind of narrow-minded and miserable kind of attitude is extremely detrimental to any kind of spiritual progress. So dana is the habit of giving and sharing to the extent which it becomes habitual and just becomes second nature to want to share whatever one has. Giving and sharing contribute significantly to sense of self-respect and self-esteem, a sense that one can do something positive in the world. It's a wonderful store bank of memories of ways in which you tangibly created happiness in the world, which you can draw upon and can give rise to great joy and peace in your mind. It's a way of creating bonds and harmony and friendship and warmth in communities. And fundamentally, as a barami, it means your attitude is not of grasping at what you have and wanting to take hold of it and keep hold of it and squeeze the absolute maximum out of it, but changing your whole attitude to the material world is something that you find your true joy in sharing. Someone once said that your possession, the things that you look upon as yours, are only yours to the extent to which you could give them away, which sounds paradoxical, but I think quite an interesting idea. So giving, sharing, giving material things, giving time, giving sympathy, giving love and kindness to others, sharing knowledge, sharing skills, sharing truth, wisdom, things that you've learned in your life with other people. This is the basic way of opening the heart up and preparing it for higher levels of spiritual progress. Second barami is sila. There's two aspects of sila or virtue. One is the inner virtue of sila, and second is the virtuous behavior. So sila is often spoken about in terms of precepts, keeping precepts. And precepts form the basis for recollection. The essence of sila is intention. And the true virtue, which is a barami and performs this maturing function, is the intention to refrain from harmful actions of body and speech. So the precepts are what give a particular form to that. So, for instance, you have an intention to harm, for instance, or to steal. That's the unwholesome intention. Now, if you've developed and given great importance to the countervailing intention to refrain from stealing, then with the intention to refrain from stealing, then that inner virtue appears in the mind. But the actual act of restraint and refraining is the external expression of it. But those two things are obviously very connected. And the Buddha said you should look after sila like you look after your eyes. And they are what protects you and prevents you from creating very, very heavy kamma. My teacher Ajahn Chah would say, if you look after sila, sila will look after you. In the monk's discipline, we have huge number of rules or training rules to follow. And there are various different categories and different levels of severity. And the idea behind that is that you have an outer ring, if you like, of the minor offences, and then the most serious offences are kind of right in the centre, so like with sort of concentric circle of walls, protective walls around them. So let's take the case of the parajika rule, or the expulsion rule for a monk of sexual intercourse with the woman. Now, there are all kinds of minor rules which determine how a monk relates to a member of the other sex, a woman. And one of them is that a monk's not allowed to speak alone with a woman, or to be alone with a woman. He always has to have a chaperone with him. And so if you keep that kind of rule, even though sometimes, well, you don't, it seems ridiculous, it's not really necessary, and so on and so forth. But if a monk keeps that rule, it's like sort of the outer ring of the discipline, then of course there's no way he's going to break the more serious rules. And so if you take particular rules and precepts out of context and you just look at them, that just seems so ridiculous. It seems like kind of really kind of finicky and over the top. But when they're seen in the context of a whole disciplinary structure and a whole way of protecting the mind, then they become a lot more reasonable. And it's the important factor here is that these precepts have to be taken on voluntarily. If you feel that you're being forced to keep precepts, then they won't give rise to the sila, which is a barami or is an inner virtue. So this is voluntarily taking on boundaries for one's actions and speech, the foundation of sila. So the next point is nekamma, which means renunciation. And it's not so much what you renounce, or that you can renounce this, you can renounce that, that you're an inherently sort of virtuous or special, but having developed the ability to renounce things that you like, not because they're necessarily bad or evil or anything like that, but to simplify the mind, simplify one's life, and to develop a new, more easygoing and unrestrained relationship to the sensual world in particular. This overlaps a little bit with precepts, and as you may know, there are five precepts of the lay person on the one prat day or on special occasions, are expanded to 8 precepts, in which lay people take the precept of celibacy for a day and a night, and they refrain from taking an evening meal and from entertainments and music and TV and makeup and adorning the body and so on. Not because, as I say, these things, watching TV or wearing makeup is wrong, but it's a way of simplifying one's life and to step back from one's usual way of living in the world and being able to take stock and to see whether it's on the middle way, or it's something's getting a little bit overdone and leading to unnecessary stress and difficulties in your life. So the ability to refrain and to put down and to abstain and to renounce certain things, whether it's just for a short period or more permanently, in the case of, say, alcohol or cigarettes or something like that, is affected by and affects your meditation practice. That is to say, if you have a habit and you've developed this ability just to put down things you like for certain periods and not let yourself get too caught up with them, or to have a certain amount of self-discipline around one's relationship to them, then when you're meditating and your mind starts to wander off and you're starting to enjoy some memory or fantasy and thinking about this and that, then your ability to put that down and return to your meditation object is an act of renunciation. So if you have developed this ability to renounce things in your daily life, then you're likely to be able to renounce the enjoyment of certain mental states in meditation much more easily. And conversely, if you practice meditation on a regular basis and you're trying to keep your mind in the present moment, a particular object, and the mind wanders off, you realize it's wandered off, and you voluntarily, quite happily, put down your interest and indulgence in that particular mental state, then that too will help your ability to renounce other things in your daily life. So renunciation, as they say, is really aimed at simplifying life and finding what's really the optimum amount of enjoyment and stimulation that one needs, rather than seeking after more and more stimulation and never knowing the right amount, what we call padi. So next point is wisdom, or banya. So we have three kinds of wisdom usually referred to in Buddhist teachings. One is the wisdom that you get from hearing things that are useful to you in your life, absorbing relevant information that you can make use of to reduce the amount of suffering in your life and maximize the amount of wholesome happiness. This is wisdom. Hearing various things, reading, absorbing from various sources, and then being able to put those together and drawing some conclusions or developing new perspectives, new ways of looking at things. This would be a second level of wisdom. The third level of wisdom is the wisdom that arises when the mind is in a state of calm, when the mind has been freed from its usual attachment to the past and the future, and it's put down its usual agitation and superficiality. Then in the calm, still, bright mind, then insights into the nature of body and mind, nature of existence, can arise very naturally in a way that they will not in any other state. So those are the three kinds of wisdom. The Buddha is really stressing in everyday life is that capacity to be present, to experience, and to be able to look and investigate the way things are, what's happening, without bias and prejudice through desire, aversion, confusion, fear, and so on. So mindfulness is the important prerequisite for wisdom. If you have mindfulness, it means that the mind is not being swept away by the emotions of the moment, but is grounded in the situation and grounded in the recognition of just what's going on right now. The ability to think and reflect on experience, to give some time to go over particular situations and difficulties with a mind which is reasonably calm and still, and being able to look at the pros and the cons, the advantages, the disadvantages, being able to flip things over and look at them in different ways and in different perspectives is a development of wisdom. So the next one is patient endurance. This is probably of all the virtues the most important one, and the Buddha in fact said it's the supreme incinerator of defilements. If you have patience, then you know, if I would say, if you had to choose any one virtue, and you know, to give a child, and you say, what one virtue can I instill in a child and be sure that, you know, that child will do reasonably well in his life and be reasonably happy, and I would say without a doubt patience, because without patience almost none of the other virtues will develop sufficiently. And with patience, being able to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant, Which would be my definition of patience. It's not sort of gritting your teeth and just waiting. If you like gritting your teeth, that kind of patience means you're very aware of the passing of time. Whereas the true patience, it's not time bound. And there's a sense of being with, not fighting, not feeling oppressed by the unpleasant. Just being willing there to be totally there and present to it. Having said that, of course, it's not to say that patience is a panacea or is always appropriate. There are certain times when it's obviously not wise, not appropriate to patiently endure. Some things have to be changed, some things have to be opposed. Sometimes you have to say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not just put up with it anyway. So it's just not a teaching of passivity, and each of these virtues cannot really be taken out of their context. Mindfulness, as I said, which is not one of the baramis, but definitely is a necessary part of a wise person's life, is that which tells you when you should be patient and when you should apply yourself to dealing with situation more directly or more actively. It's easy to be patient when you're living with those with people who think you're wonderful or with people who are trying to make you happy. It's a lot more difficult when you're with people that you don't like and situations that you don't like. And this is why in some of the texts they say that your greatest benefactor is your enemy, because he's the person or she's the person that forces you to be patient. Otherwise you might not ever develop that kind of patience and endurance. The patient endurance is one of the great pillars of monastic training. And when I was first in Thailand 30 years ago in Wat Bapong, we right from the very first day, I have to sit like this, which I'd never sat in this posture before. I'd done a number of sitting of walking meditation and sitting for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours at a time like this, and we didn't have any mats, just on a concrete floor, and so it was sort of tough, really. But you know, if I think what's noticeable, if you feel that what you're doing is painful and difficult and it's pointless, then you can't do it. But if you have a certain confidence that there's a reason behind it and it's sort of good for you in a way, then you can be a lot more patient than you thought you might be able to be. And we used to do this sitting all through the night, from 6 in the evening through till 5-6 in the morning, when you could get up every now and again to go to the toilet or something. But then first thing in the morning, then you haven't eaten for 24 hours, for walking 3 or 4 kilometers into the village to collect food on arms round and so on. But because it's part of the life, you don't really feel it's anything very special. But it's only after a number of months or years that you realize just exactly what you have developed through doing that. I think the ability, as I say, to bear with the unpleasant, not instantly to react to what we don't like and try to get away from it, it does mean we're able to penetrate situations and see things a lot more clearly than otherwise, without that ideal, and without taking patience as something that you actually want to develop, that you wouldn't really do that. I mean, maybe we say, well, patience is something that, yeah, if you're in a corner and you don't have any kind of alternative, yes, you can be patient. But there's quite a, that's quite a difference from taking patient endurance as actually something that you really want to develop and to see its importance. Wirya is the next point, which means effort. And in fact, wira means like hero in Pali or Thai, so it's like heroic effort. But that doesn't really mean it's on a very high level necessarily. There are four kinds of effort. So one is the effort to protect the mind and not to allow unwholesome mental states that have not yet arisen from arising. Second one is, in the case where you're not able to do that, then putting forth the effort to reduce or to eliminate the unwholesome dhammas that have arisen. And the next one is to develop wholesome dhammas not yet arisen, and then to develop the wholesome ones that have already developed to a higher level. So that in itself is a good framework for any kind of spiritual effort in spiritual life in general. The effort to protect, the effort to abandon, the effort to develop, and the effort to bring to maturation. And the Buddha, in fact, defined what he was teaching in terms of, you know, in the various categories of religious teaching that were available at that time, as this is a teaching of effort. He said this religion is characterized by its emphasis on effort. In the Buddhist time, there were all kinds of strange religious teachings, some of them very fatalistic, and the idea that everything's predetermined, and so effort is a waste of time because whatever you do, it's going to turn out just the same anyway. Or that everything's dependent on the will of God, and similarly, well, why put forth effort, because it's going to make any difference. So the Buddha says effort does make a difference, that we make our life moment by how we act. It's not what we believe in, but it's what we do which determines the quality of our lives. So effort is the next point. Next one is satya, truth, love of truth, the commitment to truth, being truthful, honest in all situations. So being honest doesn't mean, you know, you have to say everything that's in your mind, and that's being honest. It's you also have to know time and place and what's appropriate to express and what's not. But that habit of being honest and facing up to things and being sincere, both to yourself and to the people around you. They said in all the many lifetimes that the Buddha to be, who we call the Bodhisattva, was developing these baramis. He broke or he sort of betrayed every single one of them at one point or another, except for this barami, the satya barami. This was the most important one in a way. So I think that love and movement towards truth is a wonderful jewel of the mind, and I think it distinguishes people quite clearly. Like someone who's never had that kind of love and devotion to truth, then a lot of spiritual life can just seem pointless. And and if you have developed that love for truth, then you can't think how you could live any other way than trying to develop spiritually. You realize that how much of one's life is conditioned by assumptions, faulty assumptions and attachments and the unwillingness or inability to look at the truth. It's been said that human beings are unable to face up to the truth for any length of time, but what the Buddha is saying is that we can develop the capacity to be with the truth on a more and more profound level through this particular kind of training. Next point is adhitana, which means like to make vows and sort of determination. So the value of this, before I came to Thailand, I made a determination that I was going to be a monk for 5 years, come what may, even if I found it totally miserable and didn't like it at all. I was just going to stay for 5 years. And so, in comparison with some friends of mine, I found it quite easy as a young monk, because you can disrobe, you can leave the monkhood very easily. You don't even have to perform a ceremony. All that's needed is just to say to one other person who understands your meaning that I'm not a monk anymore. So if you say I'm not a monk anymore, and you mean it, and that person understands it, then that's it. You're not a monk anymore. It's as simple as that. So it can be difficult to become a monk, but it's very easy to leave the monkhood. It's sort of like getting born and dying, I suppose. But what it means is that as a young monk, if you're going through a lot of difficulties and struggles, then it's always going to be in the back of your mind, you know, well, God, I had enough, you know, this is too much. I think I just leave. So I found the advantage of making that firm vow to stay for 5 years meant that when I had problems or difficulties, then my mind wouldn't go that way at all, because come what may, I was going to stay. And so being put on the spot there, you've got no choice, you've got to deal with this. How are you going to deal with this? And that's a very different mindset to how am I going to deal with this? Shall I deal with this? Or shall I just forget all about it? So if you have a very doubting mind, and you know, shall I do this, shall I do that, and never being able to really commit yourself to anything in any concerted way, then this is a very good skillful means to set yourself particular goals and to make a firm determination to realize that goal, and it can bring up a lot of energy and determination in the mind. And of course, this is a very good feeling when you're able to accomplish that. Wisdom is needed in not setting your goals too high that becomes impossible to reach them, and then you get more depressed than you were in the beginning. The next one is metta, or loving kindness. And metta is a sense of goodwill, wishing well. And it's not restricted to any one particular person. It is a universal sense of goodwill. Again, this is one of the reasons why monks and nuns, monastics, are celibate, so that it becomes much easier to develop this kind of universal well-wishing, loving kindness, when one doesn't have these very strong personal family attachments. And loving kindness is something that cleanses the mind of anger and ill will, and gives a great deal of joy and happiness to the mind. And the there are many many nice stories about metta. I think there's one I remember of a bandit chief in Tibet, and he was on a raid of a caravan going through the countryside in Tibet, and so he and his band of bandits rode down into the caravan, and there's heavy fighting. And in the course of the fighting, a pregnant horse was stabbed or was fatally wounded. And in the stress of that, the horse gave birth to foal. And the bandit chief saw this dying horse in great pain, trying to lick the foal, and see that mother's love at that time of awful pain, stress, just something that just clicked in his mind, and just thought how much more beautiful and noble the mind of that horse was than his own very cruel and greedy mind. And so the story goes that he gave up his banditry and subsequently became one of the great monks of Tibet some 200 or 300 years ago. There's another Tibetan story, I tell you, that you may have heard this one, about the man and his two wives living off in the middle of nowhere. And one of the wives had a child, and the other wife didn't have any children. She was jealous. And then the husband died. So the two women went into the local town, and the woman who didn't have a child claimed that the child was hers. And of course nobody knew who was the real mother. And so it went to the court, and both mothers swore that this child was their child. And so how was the judge to decide? So he told them to grab an arm and a leg each and pull. And whoever won could have the child. So they started to pull, and the child, of course, started to cry. And the moment the child started to cry in pain, the real mother let the child go. And so the other woman, having the child, and she said, "Yes, I won." And then, so of course, the judge says, "Give the child to the other woman. She must be the mother, because she was the one that couldn't bear to see the child in pain." So this idea of metta is often compared with the love of a mother for its only child. But it's that same kind of absolute, unconditional love, but spread out to all beings, not just restricted to one's own child, but that kind of absolute love which depends and relies and expects nothing in return is the kind of idea that of metta. Then the last of these points is upekkha, or equanimity. There's an evenness of mind, and this is the ability to maintain the mind on an even keel. Depends on wisdom, reflection, reflecting on law of karma, for instance, to know that we all have karma as our refuge, and that maybe we want to help other people and to reduce their suffering and to make them happy, but we're often not able to do that, maybe through our own faults or through the situation, or perhaps simply because that person's not yet ready to be helped. And with upekkha, we're able to keep our mind on that even keel, and to be equanimous and not to feel sad and hurt and rejected because our good intentions have been rejected, but to be in that state of readiness that whenever anything changes, that one will return to that effort to help that person and to do that good thing. So that's that. This is equanimity in terms of keeping the mind free from suffering, even when it's frustrated in its efforts to do good. But equanimity also means ability to be even-minded in the midst of the loka dhammas, meaning praise and blame and gain and loss and status and loss of status and pain and pleasure and all these very normal things that surround us. The story we often tell is in the 70s, through the 60s, Ubon, where my monastery is situated, had a huge American army base. There was about 20,000-30,000 American servicemen there throughout most of the 60s during the Vietnam War. And some of the airmen learnt Thai language, very few of them, but mostly they didn't speak Thai. So one of the tuk-tuk drivers, he picked up this American serviceman from the base and he was taking him into a nightclub or something, and they stopped at the red light, and his friend inside the tuk-tuk says, where are you going? He says, oh, I'm taking this American dog to the nightclub. Now, I think any of you who not Thai, but you know that calling somebody a dog is a pretty kind of serious thing in Thailand. You know, in the West, you used to call somebody an old dog. You know, it's quite affectionate. You know, he's got a loyal man's best friend, that kind of thing. In Thailand, it's it's serious. So anyway, they got to the. He didn't realize that the guy understood Thai, you see. You see, thinking just as, Farang doesn't know Thai. So they got to there, and then he's sort of saying, 20 baht. And then the serviceman answered in perfect Thai, dogs don't carry money, and just walked off. So, he was able just to keep his mind completely calm. And even so, if you lose it and you get angry over things, then you lose your sense of balance and judgment, and so being able to keep your sense of groundedness and equanimity. A bit like those, I don't know whether this is an appropriate simile, but tanks. These tanks that go through the desert and they go up and down, but around the sort of the gun turrets able to keep stable because they have this kind of computerized system which maintains a steady. I think it's a bit like that, maybe. But this is what you can do with this practice. So these are like 10 dhammas which kind of form a whole kind of framework. So you can see in your daily life, I don't have any time to meditate, but there's always one of those, at least one of those 10 things that you can be doing anywhere, I guarantee, wherever you are, the most, whether you're in a bus station, walking along the road, you're in an office, you're at school, you're at home, there's always, a number of these baramis that you can be developing. It's a matter of, you try to learn them off by heart and then being able to sort of integrate them into your life. So there's dana, there's giving, sharing, generosity, and there's sila, this ability to, as they say, taking on voluntarily certain clearly defined boundaries for your behavior. Then nekamma, needing to be turning away, like going through the city, like all these advertisements, pulling you out in every direction, and just being aware of just that sort of magnetic, that's the way your eyes are just being pulled towards those things, and just to be able to turn away. So there's a sense of sense restraint and renunciation. It's not such a big thing to renounce, but unless you take it on as something you particularly want to do and you particularly want to develop, it becomes an intention in your mind, then you probably won't do it. Look at this, look at that. And then when you get home, just why you feel so drained. It's because there was all the energy is going out through your eyes and ears and nose all the time. So it's a matter of sort of caring and knowing how to care for the sort of energy in your body and being aware in the way that it kind of streams out through the senses. So being able to renounce certain things, put them down, let them go, simplify. Using wisdom, intelligence to reflect on experience, learning from experiences, patient endurance, patient coexistence with the unpleasant, putting forth effort. As Buddha says, the lazy person always has a good excuse. It's too early, it's too late, it's too hot, it's too cold. I'm too hungry, I'm too full, I'm too tired, I'm too energetic, I don't want to sit down. There's always a good reason, not to do the things which would be the most beneficial for you to do. So putting that, having that interest in putting forth effort into, guarding the mind against the unwholesome, abandoning the unwholesome, developing the wholesome, bringing forth the wholesome and perfecting it and developing it further. Truth, the commitment to truth, determination, setting yourself particular goals and keeping them, loving kindness and equanimity. You can remember all those. It's good to remember them in pairs. A lot of these long lists have certain similarities. So metta and upekkha, the two last ones, loving kindness and equanimity of mind. They're like this pair of like mature emotions, if you like. Before that, there was saccha and adhittana, truth and determination, and those two are like a good pair. And then patience and effort. Renunciation and wisdom, the first two, dana and sila. So those are the 10 baramis, and those are the first part of the afternoon, concludes this point. And so I'd like to give you the opportunity to stretch your legs and relax for a few minutes, and then we'll have a meditation session. Mm-hmm.